took months to ramp up our testing capacity. The Omicron, we saw how vital, and with Omicron, we saw how vital it was. And we have enough tests on hand to weather the surge. But without funding, we're not going to be able to sustain the testing capacity beyond the month of June. And if we fail to invest, we leave ourselves vulnerable if another wave of the virus hits.
That was President Biden a few months ago asking Congress to authorize more money for COVID-related programs like testing. Well, it's July, and that request is still unfulfilled as negotiations have broken down. Republicans say there was enough funding for testing, but that money was diverted away to other measures like vaccines and treatment. Meanwhile, Omicron BA5 is now the dominant variant of COVID, and it's spreading at levels unseen with previous strains. At last report, the test positivity rate in California was approaching 17%. And that's likely a vast undercount because no one quite knows how much it has spread, as home tests are mostly either unreported or the data isn't being gathered. But it feels like everyone is getting COVID right now. So in the midst of summer travel season, how should you approach testing and what does a negative home result really mean? Omi Garner is Director of Clinical Microbiology for the UCLA Health System, and he's with us. Hey, Omi.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. We're so happy we could get you on today. As I said, you know, it's summer and people are traveling. They're going out with friends, I think trying to kind of, you know, get back to normal in some way. But infections are just surging and we're seeing this uptick in hospitalizations. So what are you seeing right now in terms of these new variants and how things look around home tests? Are they accurate?
Well, I will say the good news with the new variants is that they do seem to be performing from a testing perspective same as previous versions of COVID. So the tests are working. I do think that the challenge we have with home testing is the tests aren't necessarily working in the same way. And so what I think that means is that with the new variant, and we saw this with early Omicron variants as well, people, especially vaccinated people, were more likely to see false negative home tests early in infection that then were turning positive a few days later, a few days after symptomatic illness has started.
And that's true with this subvariant as well. So what's the advice for folks at home? If you have the sniffles, you take a test, it says it's negative. How many days should you continue testing? How should you proceed after that if you are worried about infecting other people?
Sure, it's a great question. So I think that the initial response to that is if you're feeling sick and you take a home test and it's negative and you do have access to a PCR, and I know we still have challenges around PCR access, a PCR hasn't shown the same level of false positivity. So if you can get a PCR on that initial day and it's negative, you can be confident that you're negative for COVID. But if you don't have PCR availability, we're really suggesting you wait 48 to 72 hours before you test again on a home antigen test. And then if that one is negative, you can have a higher confidence in not having COVID. I think the question is, what do you do in the meantime, right? How do you behave in those 2-3 days? And I think, you know, isolation may not be possible, but I think that that's a really good time to mask up, right? To really have a mask on and try not to infect others because you are possibly contagious with COVID.
Right. Although that might not be an option for folks, especially with kids getting, because I've noticed there are summer colds and flus going around too, right? I'm curious, though, are masks working the same way with these more infectious subvariants?
Masks are still highly effective. I think what you're seeing is that they're just not being used very often, right? Mm-hmm. How often now when we walk around do we really see people masking? And so I think the challenge is, as we've reduced masking overall, we are seeing an increase in infection. And to your point, COVID isn't the only thing that's circulating. We've seen some late season flu, and then all the normal cold viruses seem to be back as well. So I think symptomatically, it's very hard to predict, based on the symptoms a person has, exactly what disease they have.
Totally. And I assume when you talk about masks, you're not talking about the cloth mask we were all using a few years ago. You're talking about more high quality masks.
Yeah, either double-layered surgical masks or, of course, N95s, KN95s, KN94s, really the masks that stop or prevent transmission.
So what about outside? Because it felt like for a long time we had this sort of protection, or at least we could breathe a little easier that if you were outside, it wasn't as big of a deal. Are we seeing this spread in outside circumstances?
I think when there's a condensed population, the answer is yes. So concerts or, you know, places where you have a highly condensed population outside, you're still sharing breathing space with a lot of people. But I do think that not having a mask on outside and then sort of sitting away from people or not having a condensed population. But, you know, the challenge there, I think, is really about eating. You know, because the challenge is when you're sitting across from somebody and they're eating, there's quite a bit of sort of breath and spit shared across the table. And so being outside may not save you from the person across from you having COVID.
All right. I will just ask you one more thing and then let you go. But another thing I'm hearing about anecdotally is folks who test positive and get over all their symptoms and 12, 15 days later are still getting positive antigen tests. If that happens, how worried should you be about being contagious? Is it possible to safely resume work, travel if you're masked? And I mean, are you still contagious? Like if you have that positive antigen test, but it's been even a couple weeks.
Yeah, antigen testing as someone is recovering from infection is not a perfect marker for contagiousness. So the general rule we use is that antigen testing or not, after 10 days from symptom onset, a person is no longer contagious. It's only in the most extreme circumstances of an immune-compromised patient would they still have live virus. So we don't even suggest doing antigen testing after 10 days. Antigen testing is very useful at day 5. To really see, because some of the early rules allow you to sort of go back to either work or interact with people. So that's where antigen testing is its most useful. So I would say after day 10, a person can assume they are no longer contagious.
Okay, that is good to hear. Good news you can use. That's Omai Gardner. He is Director of Clinical Microbiology for the UCLA Health System. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
To lower the cost of care for the millions of Californians with diabetes, Governor Gavin Newsom said Thursday that California will be the first state to make its own insulin.
California is now taking matters into our own hands. The budget I just signed sets aside $100 million so that we can contract to make our own insulin at a cheaper price, close to at cost, and to make it available to all.
The news comes as more and more Americans struggle to pay for insulin. And that's because the price of the diabetes drug without insurance can range anywhere from $300 to $500 a month and thousands of dollars per pack for insulin pens. Angela Hart is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Welcome, Angie.
Thank you.
So you have been following this, and I want to start off with just what the governor announced. Can you explain the details of what he's talking about?
Yeah, so Governor Newsom essentially talked about a plan to pour $100 million into this unprecedented effort to enlist California government to make its own insulin. The $100 million is from the state budget, which was recently passed, and essentially puts California on this trajectory to begin trying to make insulin in the future.
So do we know anything about when it could be available, how much it could cost, like what should consumers be looking out for?
Yeah, great question. There's a lot of questions surrounding this plan. It's extremely ambitious. The timeline, I've asked the governor, the Newsom administration repeatedly about this. They'll just say in the next 2 to 3 years. And I would also note that in terms of the cost, there are some companies who are talking about producing this for about, if we're talking about a vial of insulin, about $30 a vial. Right now, I've talked to several diabetics who are paying a couple hundred, $300, $400 a month for this.
And that's without insurance. With insurance, is it less?
Depending on your health insurance plan, people pay different depending on your deductible and the details of your plan. But yes, this really does try to significantly reduce the out-of-pocket costs that consumers are paying.
Okay, well, let's talk about why this costs so much. I mean, some research shows that a vial of insulin costs around $2 to $6 to produce. And there are basically, I think, three big manufacturers, Eli Lilly, Nordisk, and Sanofi, who make most of this. Are they the reason this is so pricey? Is it middlemen? Like, how does this whole system work?
Everyone shares the blame here. The pharmaceutical companies share the blame for charging high sticker prices. The pharmacy middlemen, sometimes referred to as pharmacy benefit managers, these PBMs have been blamed for driving up, contributing to the high price of insulin. And insurance companies too share the blame. And, you know, this really is a largely unregulated market. So when you take a step back and you really look at it, the blame really is shared across the board, although you do often see a lot of finger pointing.
Right. Do you think that, I mean, is there a role in which or a world in which the state becoming part of this can cut out, like, say, the pharmacy benefit managers, those middlemen, or change that structure?
This is what I will be watching, that the Newsom administration really has to grapple with going forward to if they have any hopes of making this plan successful. So I would point out, first of all, the state wants to make this cheaper insulin available to, quote, millions of Californians, regardless if you're insured or uninsured. Now, how are they going to get that product to consumers? That's a major question. And that is something that hasn't been publicly discussed yet. Now, I will say that State Health and Human Services Secretary Mark Galli, who is helping spearhead this initiative, said that these conversations are in full force right now, and the administration is definitely committed to figuring out how it can convince the PBMs and the insurers to pick this drug up. But they also know that even if they don't, this is still going to be widely available over the counter to anybody.
Right. Well, I mean, this is like a perennial issue, right? We hear this conversation every time there's a major election. We know that last month, two U.S. senators introduced a bill to place a $35 a month cap on the cost of insulin. But they have not succeeded in doing this nationally. And you sound a little skeptical about the ability of the state to do this. I mean, is this more of a political question or a logistical one? Like, why is it so difficult to help millions of Americans suffering like this?
I would separate that into sort of two categories. First off, like the politics, you cannot divorce the politics from this intense debate, especially at the national level. Congress, you know, pharmaceutical companies, these drug companies are major political contributors, including to Democrats. And that really has torpedoed, I think, a lot of the efforts at the federal level. Now, in California is trying, has proposed in the past, and has tried to do much of what the federal government wants to do, which is really to limit what patients are paying. I would note that doesn't actually get at the overall sort of sticker price, if you will,
right?
The overall price, which really is driving up. That's what's causing a lot of the consternation. And if you keep the prices intact, but just lower the cost for consumers, that really keeps the money flowing to the pharmaceutical companies and, you know, the middlemen and all of the people throughout the pharmaceutical distribution chain are still making hand over fist. So I would say the debate in California is actually much different than at the federal level, where they're actually trying. And I would note that State Senator Richard Pan, who really is the one who launched this initiative last year, 2 years ago, they want to get at the overall price by directly going after the pharmaceutical companies making insulin and make something much cheaper.
All right, Angie, just a few seconds left. But if the state can do this, if they can get at some of those issues and tackle it, then is there a path to go after other pharmaceutical drugs, generic drugs? Maybe California could be a provider of this and a manufacturer.
Absolutely. So I would just, that's an important point. The insulin is just the tip of the spear here. That's where California really is starting. But this is nowhere near ending at insulin. The state has a broader plan to produce generic drugs across the board. Now it's going to target, only certain drugs, some drugs that might be in particularly short supply or might experience, you know, a significantly higher cost due to market failures. And I would also just note that I would pay attention to this company. We have a small indication perhaps of who's going to be having the state contract to get this up and running in California. And this is a Utah-based generic drug manufacturer called Civica. And they actually just got into the generic insulin market this year. And they're in negotiations with the Newsom administration. So that is where we can really look to see some of this debate rolling over producing generic insulin and a wide range of other drugs at lower prices.
All right. We will keep watching this. I know you will, too. Angela Hart is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, it is our weekly Legal Eagle segment with Jessica Levinson. We'll talk about the ongoing battle between Twitter's board and billionaire Elon Musk. And we'll try to sort out why former Trump advisor Steve Bannon has finally agreed to testify before Congress. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Madeline Brand. The battle between Elon Musk and Twitter continued this morning. Musk posted pictures of himself laughing hysterically with captions reading, "They said I couldn't buy Twitter, now they want to force me to buy Twitter in court." The question is, can Twitter force Elon Musk to follow through on the $44 billion deal to buy the social media giant? And meanwhile, in our nation's capital, former Trump strategist Steve Bannon has finally agreed to testify before the January 6th committee, days before a criminal trial for defying the committee's subpoena. But that didn't come without a permission slip from his former boss, Donald Trump. Here to talk about it is Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle. Hey, Jessica.
Hey, welcome. Hello.
Thank you. So happy to be here this week. All right. So let's talk about Bannon first. He claims that he had a change of heart after receiving a letter from the former president waiving executive privileges and giving him permission to testify. Did he need that permission?
He really didn't. And his claim of executive privilege was frankly so weak that it really was more about, I think, defying this congressional committee and seeing when they would refer a contempt of Congress charge and whether or not the Department of Justice would go ahead with it. He doesn't have to wait for the former president. And frankly, any lawyer should have told him there's no there when it comes to this executive privilege claim.
All right. Well, we have seen some incredible testimony in recent weeks from Justice Department lawyers, White House staffers who were in the room with Trump during the insurrection. Bannon left the White House in, I think, 2017. So what do you think the committee wants from him?
So I think they're not going to get much, but what they would want would be, did you talk to the president about the lead up? Do you know what his plans were? Do you know what he anticipated? Do you know what he intended? Had you talked to the Proud Boys? Basically, what did the president know leading up and what did he expect would happen? I will say, if we actually hear from Steve Bannon, I don't know that we're going to get a lot of information. I think we're going to hear a lot of what we heard from people like Michael Flynn, which is, I plead the fifth.
Yeah. Well, one interesting thing I've noticed is that Bannon, as well as the head of the Oath Keepers, both said they would testify, but they only would do it in public. Why do you think they're offering it in that manner? And it seems to me like this committee has been very, very carefully scripted on purpose. So it doesn't seem like that's something they might go for.
So I don't think that they'll go for that. They shouldn't go for that because it shouldn't be up to him to determine the basically time, place, and manner of his particular testimony. But it's interesting because a lot of people say, oh, well, nobody's watching the January 6th committee hearings. This would indicate that at least Steve Bannon and the head of the Oath Keepers
Trump.
Think that people, yeah, that people are watching and they want control, right? So they don't want their testimony to be spliced. And I'm not saying to be misrepresented, but to be spliced. They want control over the show. It's like a director. And I think that's what's going on here.
And this has been, as I said, very scripted, very directed committee approach. So we did see last week former White House counsel Pat Cipollone also agree to testify, but that was behind closed doors. Do you think we might be hearing from him in public?
So I don't know that it depends on whether or not the committee thinks we need to hear from him in public, in the sense that they said he provided new information and he also provided information that was consistent. And that's really because this isn't a court of law, because they don't have to go to a jury and prove beyond a reasonable doubt certain statutory provisions, that it's really up to them about what's the best way to present this for their various audiences. They have the American public, they have their colleagues, and they have the Department of Justice. I don't know which way they'll ultimately pull on that.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned at the top that Bannon has been ignoring the subpoena. There's a next Monday he's supposed to go to trial for ignoring it. What could happen there? Could he actually be held criminally liable for that, even if he's agreed to testify now?
He absolutely could. And it's interesting, about, I think, an hour ago or earlier on the East Coast, a hearing concluded where Steve Bannon's attorney was just completely rejected in all of his pretrial arguments. And the reporting is that he said, either in the courtroom or to the judge, basically, I have nothing left to argue. What's the point in going to trial when there's no defense? And so the harm here occurred when Steve Bannon decided, I'm not going to comply with a valid congressional subpoena, and saying months later, 8 or 9 days before trial, that a trial they're trying to delay, oh, well, now executive privilege, which never existed in the first place, is waived, and now I can actually go ahead and testify. That doesn't cure the problem, and therefore it doesn't undermine the legal theory here. Frankly, I think the prosecutors yesterday had a very strong legal theory and case going in. After that hearing this morning, they have an extremely strong case. What Steve Bannon, I think, is hoping is that he can say, look, to the jury, yeah, they're going to say a lot of legal things, but they asked me to testify. Ultimately, I did. So what's the problem?
Right. Well, and we know that this committee itself is really trying to look forward and not just think about what happened in the past, but what could happen in the next elections. And you recently wrote about how the Supreme Court might take a case that could make it easier for state legislatures to steal an election. Talk about that without getting too far into the legal weeds, Jessica.
So, yeah, very briefly, basically what the Supreme Court is going to do is hear a case on something called the independent state legislature doctrine. And that would mean that when the state makes decisions about federal elections, maybe that's drawing district lines, maybe that's deciding which slate of electors to send to the Electoral College, that it's only the state legislature who can make that call. So there'd be no safety valve for instance, a state Supreme Court to say, you can't draw congressional district lines that way. You've diluted people's votes. Or you can't send an alternative slate of electors to the Electoral College. The people have spoken. And so it would basically give state lawmakers unfettered power, unchecked power. The only person looking over them would be federal judges when it comes to these decisions based on federal elections. It's, in my mind, an absolutely watershed moment that the court decided to take the case. And relating to January 6th, it basically would legally allow states to do what part of the kind of botched plan was by at least some of President Trump's boosters.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that one. I want to switch gears. We mentioned at the top, Elon Musk is literally laughing at Twitter on Twitter. He is trying to back out of this agreement to buy the company. Can they force Musk to buy Twitter? Twitter's really readying their legal team to go to court.
Twitter has an amazing legal team that they've just hired. So can they force him to buy Twitter? The answer is that when it comes to a contract dispute like this, one of the remedies is something called specific performance, which is basically, you said you were going to buy this thing. We, Twitter, didn't breach, meaning there's no excuse for you not to buy it. So you need to buy it. Now, another route here would be that Musk would pay $1 billion in damages. But one of the remedies available, it's not a very common remedy, but one of the remedies available is, again, specific performance. You said you were going to buy the car. You said you were going to buy the washing machine. We delivered on our part. Now you go ahead and deliver on your part and buy it.
Which is kind of crazy, but $1 billion is a lot less than $44 billion. So I take it he would prefer that outcome.
I'm not sure what he would prefer. Some people are saying now he'd prefer to try and buy it at a lower price and say that this litigation, pending litigation, means that the value is lower. I think that there's a lot of publicity wrapped up in these legal arguments. I will say he's not on the strongest legal footing here.
And they did give him the information he wanted, right? All that bot information.
Yes. I think, again, based on the reporting, he basically said, I need the ingredients before I buy this product. They gave him the ingredients and they performed on their side.
All right. We'll leave it there. Jessica Levinson is a professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal eagle here on Press Play. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Up, we all use and begrudgingly love Amazon, but with 2 days of Prime discounts this week, what are the hidden costs of those deals?
The treatment of Amazon warehouse workers is actually remarkably respectful relative to the way many workers are treated when you think about the long supply chains through which a lot of the goods that you're buying on Amazon are actually made.
That's next on Press Play. Press Play on KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brand. Amazon Prime Day starts tomorrow. For those of you who don't already know, Prime Day is an annual sale for paying members. With just a few clicks, you can get just about anything from televisions to toaster ovens delivered to your door, sometimes with same-day shipping. But you probably already knew this, because love them or hate them, Amazon is the pioneer of frictionless consumption. It's hard to argue that the company has made shopping more convenient for us than we would have dreamed even 20 years ago. And even though in the back of our minds, we know there are costs to those slash prices and insane delivery speeds, we're all still hooked anyway. Our next guest is Catherine Judge. She's a law professor at Columbia University and the author of a book called Direct: The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. Catherine spent a lot of time thinking about this, and she joins us now. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, before we get too far into this, I have to come clean. I'm an Amazon Prime member, and like I think many people, I feel guilty about it sometimes, but I can't quit them. Is that something that you hear a lot?
It is something I hear incredibly often. And in all honesty, I'm in the exact same boat. And
okay.
Really, the book and the idea is like, how do we create balance? Because let's be honest, they've already squeezed out so many alternatives that at this point, it's really hard to fully avoid Amazon.
Totally. And I mean, it's like, it's all consuming, right? It's the Amazon Prime stuff you can do online. There's Whole Foods, and then there's the, you know, like books and TV. So it really is this really sort of global thing that has seeped into our lives. And I feel like lately we have been talking a lot about the downside of the model in terms of folks, you know, the impact on individuals and communities, the low wages in warehouses. But obviously this has had a huge impact on small businesses and the way they do business. What do you see as the biggest changes it has brought to the folks that want to sell through the Amazon platform?
I mean, one of the shifts that we've seen over time is that as Amazon has grown in power, which means people start their shopping on Amazon, they go to Amazon.com instead of going to Google, but also they have this incredible fulfillment center. People who want to sell elsewhere are finding it harder and harder to do so. And Amazon knows this. So the cut that it's taking of every single transaction has increased every year for the past 7 years. So on average right now, when you make a purchase on Amazon, a third of that is going to Amazon and only 2/3 is actually ever reaching the seller of the good, much less the creator far past that.
Yeah. Well, and you make this interesting parallel to the real estate market and how that has developed in the United States. Can you explain what is that similarity when we talk about middlemen?
Yeah. So what we see is that middlemen, whether it's a real estate agent, whether it's Amazon, whether it's Walmart, they come into power because they're providing a very valuable service. They're creating infrastructure that makes it a lot easier for money and goods to flow from those who have them to those who need them. They help us to find what we want and connect with others. So there's a lot of value that's provided initially. But what we consistently see is over time, all of the attributes that middlemen need to be good at their jobs are also attributes that allow them to grow outsized power. So they build incredible infrastructure that makes it easier to connect. They develop expertise, relationships. But over time, they use these to contort the law and the evolution of the market to continue to feed their power so that rather than having a healthy change that we'd expect, rather than having innovations that actually result in changes of who the relevant middlemen are, the middlemen find ways to entrench themselves and really to take a bigger cut and to leave both sides a little more disconnected.
Yeah. So this is all coming, of course, as we also confront a global supply chain crisis, record inflation. Did Amazon and some of these other powerful middlemen play a role in getting us to where we are today?
Yes, it's an indirect mechanism, but I'd say that Amazon and other intermediaries played a big role by allowing us to have effectively artificially low prices. For a very long time, the middleman economy has fed into a focus on short-term efficiency, and that has allowed us to have access to a wealth of goods incredibly conveniently at very low prices. But what we're now seeing with supply chain shock is actually that in the focus on efficiency, there was an underinvestment in resilience, in making sure that we can get goods in good times and bad. And what I explore in direct is the way the growth of the middleman economy, so it's both these very large middlemen that are both fed and help to feed these long and complex supply chains, results in a transformation of how goods are made. It used to be you actually knew the people behind the clothes that you wore, the food that you ate. Now, it's not even a person that's far away. It's a bunch of different people that are disaggregated around the world. So it also leaves a sense of disconnection and it creates this incredible fragility.
Yeah. When you also hit on the impact that that sort of disconnection from where we're getting our goods and services has on things like the environment and how workers are treated, how can we think about that? And is there a way, I don't know, is there a middle way where we're not giving this up entirely, but we can improve some of those processes?
I think that's what we have to aim for. I mean, we're not aiming for a world without middlemen. We're not aiming to get rid of Amazon. But one of the core challenges is we just don't think about them. I mean, I think more recently, there fortunately has been some great organizing at some of the Amazon warehouses and some really great publicity. I think the media has done a really nice job highlighting the almost dehumanization that occurs in terms of how people work and how they are treated. But as a practical matter, the treatment of Amazon warehouse workers is actually remarkably respectful relative to the way many workers are treated when you think about the long supply chains through which a lot of the goods that you're buying on Amazon are actually made. And we are so blinded to that. There are like fundamental values we might have regarding the environment, regarding kind of like basic like living wage and safety and consumer safety protection issues for workers, where we don't see the violations that occur. And so it's easier for us to discount them.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the difference between going to the farmer's market and Whole Foods probably illustrates that. I'm curious, though, because, you know, we both admitted we're Amazon Prime members and this is not going away. Are there particular types of goods or services we should go to Amazon for or avoid? Like, are there things we can do in the short term as consumers that might change the dynamic here at all?
I'd say there's a lot that we can do as consumers, but there's also a lot that the government has to do. So one thing you can aim to do as a consumer is balance it out a little bit. So like, let's be honest, it's going to be Amazon Prime Day. A lot of people are going to jump on Amazon. They're going to see a deal that they can't resist. And maybe you need to go ahead and let yourself do that. But just like dieting, right? Like trying to tell ourselves not to eat that dessert has never been successful. But we've learned in dieting is one of the ways you can create a little more balance is you try to get in some of the good stuff. And also realize how much you can enjoy some of the good stuff. And there's like a natural balancing that kind of happens in our diet. So part of the idea of direct is not that direct is going to become how we consume most of what we do in our lives, but just a tiny bit of it in our lives can just help to remind us there's always people and places behind the goods that we're consuming and that our actions affect them. And so as we start to feed in a little more direct, and that might mean actually going to the farmer's market or craft fair, it might mean going online where you have these incredible entrepreneurs who are, you know, using Shopify to set up a website, but are helping to import goods from around the world, but with supply chains that are much shorter, much more accountable, and where through the website, you can actually see kind of the way workers are treated much further up the chain. So it's trying to have a little of that nourishment.
Do a little of both. Absolutely. All right. Catherine Judge is the author of the book, Direct: The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Power of Going to the Source. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Coming up, 6 decades after a stunning performance at the Hollywood Bowl, a previously unheard 1958 recording of Ella Fitzgerald is being released. We'll talk to one of her former drummers. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brandt. Today, we're going back to the Hollywood Bowl in 1958.
We're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The temperature's rising, it isn't surprising. She certainly can. Started a heat wave, right let on her seat. Wave.
That is Heat Wave by the late jazz legend Ella Fitzgerald, the first lady of song. It was recorded at the Hollywood Bowl and discovered decades later in the vault of a recording studio. It's now being released on a new album called Ella at the Hollywood Bowl, the Irving Berlin Songbook. Joining me now to talk about her and her time at the Hollywood Bowl is Greg Field. He's a Grammy Award-winning musician and producer who played drums for Ella Fitzgerald's band in the 80s. And he also discovered the recordings of her performance at the Hollywood Bowl and mixed the new album. Welcome to Press Play, Greg.
Marisa, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
What an amazing story and new album. Can we talk about your personal story, though, first? How did you meet Ella Fitzgerald?
I was a drummer in school, you know, elementary school, junior high school, up in the Bay Area, and became obsessed with Count Basie's band. And when I was a senior in high school, Ella and Basie were playing a concert at a theater just south of San Francisco. And I asked my dad if I could go every night, and I did. Wow. And I stood outside the stage door to watch the guys come up. And anyway, this one night, I actually make it backstage, and I'm standing in the wings as the band is about to go on stage, Basie's band. And the band manager comes up and said to Basie, you know, Sonny Payne's not here. And that was the drummer. And Basie said, didn't you say you were a drummer? I said, yeah. And he said, you want to play? And I had been obsessed with this band for years. And I literally played the concert for him. And during concert, somebody went back and told Ella that some kid, high school kid out of the audience, was playing drums with Basie. And I met her that night. And that was in December of 1973. And then a few years later, Basie actually called me and I joined his band. And I spent 3 years with him. And during those years, we would do a lot of concerts with Ella. So the relationship grew. And then she eventually asked me to join her permanently. And I spent about a year and a half with her until, unfortunately, she had a heart attack on the road and it kind of sidelined her for a couple of years. And from there, I moved on to Frank Sinatra, actually.
What a story, Greg.
So that's the brief version of it, that we could actually talk for 4 hours.
Yeah, that is incredible. Well, tell me a little bit more. What was she like to work with? Was she a commanding boss? High expectations, I take it?
She was two people, Marisa. She was off stage. She was the sweetest, most humble, kind, generous woman, always buying, you know, her guys gifts. And she was wonderful. But when we got on stage, she turned into Frank Sinatra. She was hardcore. You better bring it. Never, you know, took her foot off the gas. And it was intense every night. She never, ever, as they say, phoned it in. We're talking to probably the greatest jazz singer of all time. She didn't get there by accident. And, you know, she wanted guys that could bring that level of intensity with her.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Well, let's play a little bit more music from that night. This is Ella Fitzgerald singing Putting on the Ritz.
Mix where Rockefeller walked with sticks, umbrellas in their mix. Putting on a Ritz, putting on a Ritz, putting on a Ritz, putting on a Ritz.
Thank you. Well, I changed that melody.
Which Ella's allowed to do, obviously. Can you tell us just the energy she brought to the stage? I mean, what was it like being there in person?
You know, everybody in the audience felt like we were all in it together with Ella. When she was singing something like that, like Putting on the Ritz, you know, she had a kind of a Cheshire grin. She would laugh, and you could almost hear her smiling as she's singing that song. And, you know, when she would swing, there's an inherent joy that she would bring, you know. And then if she sang a lyric, you know, a little bit on the risque side, you know, she'd giggle and laugh. And it's like we were all together. It was quite remarkable that we experienced very few artists that were able to do that. Mm-hmm. On the opposite end of that, when she sang a ballad, especially a heartfelt ballad, something like They're Writing Songs of Love, But Not For Me. Every note she sang, Marisa, was heartfelt. You know, she was not that lucky in love. She was married for a short time in the late 40s to Ray Brown, the famous jazz bassist. But after they broke up, she really didn't have a man in her life, and she was lonely. And she was wired so that when she actually sang a story, you were basically being let in on who she is and her world. There are very few singers that do that. Sinatra did it. Luther Vandross certainly was that. Tony Bennett, they tell stories. And especially with Ella, it was a window into who she was.
Yeah. Well, we have one of those ballads. This is her performance of the song Always. Let's listen to that for a second.
I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true always. When the things you've planned need a helping hand, when I'll be there always, not for just an hour, not for just a day, not for just a year, but
you can hear what you're talking about, Greg, in the song, right? And that yearning. And she did have, I mean, not just as an adult, but such a tough life from the time she was really born. Do you think, yes, like, how do you think about that sort of juxtaposition between who she was on stage and who she was in life? I can imagine that the fame may have made her more lonely in a way.
Oh, no, that's exactly right. You know, people weren't comfortable just walking up to her because she was such a massive superstar. that, you know, it would be like anybody. You wouldn't think you could walk up to, you know, Lady Gaga on the street today. And you might feel, you know, a little trepidation, I suppose. But with her, early on when I first got the gig, her manager was this great guy named Pete Cavella. Her road manager said, you know, go in and say hi to Sis. And we all called her Sis. That's a name that she got when she was very young, touring with Chick Webb's band. And, you know, for me, it was a little weird because I was 29 years old. I was calling yeah. this 65-year-old woman superstar Sis. But her dressing room, unless she was changing, her dressing room door was always open. And Pete would say, you know, go in and say hi to Sis. And she would just be sitting in there by herself. So it was a rather lonely existence. And, you know, she really loved her band. We were much like her family for her, I suppose. We spent much more time with her than anybody else did. And when we weren't on the road, she had the most beautiful home in Beverly Hills. And we would, when we weren't out touring, we would head over to her house, the trio, and just, you know, rehearse and play. It was great. That's where she was the happiest. So the fact that she did spend most of her years on the road, that's where she wanted to be. When the things you plan need a helping hand, I will understand always, always. Things may not be fair always. That's when I'll be just a day, not for just a year, but always. When I first got this album home to my studio, and it was about 2 a.m. and I was just listening to the whole album just to get my head into it, and it got to Always, and it was just so unbelievably heartfelt, great. It was just perfect, Ellen. It was just me sitting down here in my studio alone and hearing her sing. And it was, frankly, it was really emotional. I got to tell you, that's when I really realized that what an important album this is in her history. You know, she's in the prime of her talent at that point, right? She's working all the time. I can tell you, Marisa, when you go into a studio as a musician and you're seeing music for the first time and you record it, I can't tell you how many times I've heard musicians say, wow, you know, I wish we could go back in the studio and record it now that I've had a chance to live with that music. Mm. And she was performing that music and it really got inside of her. And she Ellisized it, so to speak. And thank God somebody had some tape running.
Well, can we talk about that? Because it is so incredible to me that, to your point, you know, the potentially best jazz singer of all time would have these unfound treasures. I mean, can you talk about discovering it and just like what went through your mind and heart as that happened?
Yeah, I was doing an interview for an Italian newspaper and they said, well, what was it like discovering this? And I said, well, you know, imagine if someone discovered a Picasso that nobody knew about, and it turned out to be one of his most important works. That's what it was like. We never expected to get something that was this important or great.
Yeah.
So, you know, I knew what that energy was like, you know, to be in the playing with her and she was in a great mood. I mean, you on the Hollywood Bowl tape, you can hear how much fun she's having. And that was, yeah, I mean, that's what I experienced with her. And it was great. You know, I'm sitting in my studio and it's a lot of memories, certainly.
So to your point, like this is, her work continues to live on. Her legacy continues to live on. What do you yeah. hope that the release of these albums does for the next generation of musicians who didn't get the opportunity to meet or play with Ella Fitzgerald, but, you know, might be out there listening?
Well, the great thing is that she was one of the great, again, to use the term, storytellers. So the recordings are wonderful representations of who she was. And her music, you know, continues decade to decade. her artistry is so profound that it's proven itself to be timeless. So if there's one artist I'm not worried about people listening to in 100 years, I mean, clearly she will be the one of a handful of artists that will just decade to decade and, you know, year to year, people will find her and discover her, and she'll be beloved now and forever.
Greg, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, Marisa, completely my pleasure. And, you know, thanks for, keeping the great music torch lit for us.
We're going to keep playing Ella. That is Greg Field. He is a Grammy Award-winning musician and producer who played with Ella Fitzgerald's band. He also produced her new live album, Ella at the Hollywood Bowl, the Irving Berlin Songbook. It's out now. And let's go out on this song, Let's Face the Music and Dance.
There may be teardrops to shed, so while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance, dance. Let's face the music and dance.
That does it for Press Play today. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow Press Play on Twitter and Instagram at KCRW Press Play. And tweet at us. Tell us what you like, what you want to hear more of. You can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you get your podcast. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening today. See you tomorrow.
Let's face the music and dance.